Hello, listeners. This is FlixWest Canada. I'm Martin Kessler, and joining me today is returning guest Spencer Seams. Hi, Spencer. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Martin?
Pretty good. And excited because today we're going to be talking about four films, the female prisoner scorpion cycle, I guess. I'm not quite sure what to call this series. There's
I guess
a few different names for them.
Yeah, and there's a couple other ones without Mako Kaji.
Right, so it's there was one name I saw to describe the series. I think the Sasori Saga or Sasori series.
Oh, yeah, that's the anime, not anime.
The manga. Yeah, but the four films we're going to be talking about are Female Prisoner Number 701 Scorpion, Jailhouse 41, Beast Staple, and Grudge Song, which are the four that have Maiko Kaji as the star. And after that, it gets a little bit muddy. But she plays Nami Matsushima, a.k.a. Scorpion, who's in prison causing trouble, then out of prison causing trouble, getting revenge. There's lots of that over the course of these four films. So I'm a little bit curious, Spencer, because I know you're a big fan of this series. I've seen your avatar as Maiko Kaji in some places. I'm curious how you were introduced to the series and what your first impressions were.
It's the same story I have for almost every other episode I've been on, which is I had Fandor for a while, and the first one, 701, was on Fandor. And I watched it because I recognized the name, Maiko Kaji. And up until that point, I think I'd only seen Blaney Snowblood, which I've only seen it one time, and I don't know, maybe it's a hot take. I'm not the biggest fan of it.
I like the first one. The second one, I sort of feel like, well, these films, I'd seen the first one and I hadn't seen the sequels for a long time, partly because I sort of thought like, oh, why would you, how could you sequelize that? Like, I bet Aaron is good. And like, they weren't really available until sort of recently. Like, Arrow's done a really good job of putting out a lot of these Maiko Kaji films, like the Straight Cat Rock movies and Blind Woman's Curse. And I think, like, Synapse released the Wandering Ginza Butterfly movies a while ago, but, like, it was a little bit tricky to see some of these. And I don't know, like, I kind of put off watching the sequels just because I thought, like, there's no way they're going to be as good. Like, you know, I sort of had this association with Lady Snowblood where... Mm-hmm. You know, the first one I really like, and then the second one, it's like, does this need to exist? I don't know.
Yeah, although I haven't seen the second Lady Snowblood, but it does have Juzo Itami in one of his acting roles.
So there's a lot of little connections I noticed between, like, oh, she worked with this director on one of the Straight Cat Rock movies, and, you know, this director was second AD on something. You know, there's like a lot of little connections between some of the cast and crew in that, like, sphere of 1970s Japanese cinema, I guess you could say, which these films kind of came out at what might be considered a weird time for Japanese cinema.
Yeah, because it was when this is 72, so this is, like, towards the end of the Roman porno era. Well, the first wave of Roman porno.
These waves happen so fast, but, like, they sort of point to this as the period when, I guess, television was taking a big chunk out of the film industry, and the film industry sort of responded by getting a little bit sleazier and weirder and more experimental, you know, and a lot of, like, the old guard kind of filmmakers had a hard time maybe staying relevant or staying commercially viable. Like, back when you had the High and Low podcast... Mm-hmm. On Kurosawa, one of the episodes that I was on was the Dodeska Den episode, which also came out, like, I think 1970, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's right around this time, and you can kind of see, like, oh, everything's sort of changing, and it's getting weird, and big studios like Nakatsu, who Maiko Kaji was at before moving over to Toei, who made these films... you know, this big kind of prestigious studio, they're like, let's go all in on pornography. You know, so it was kind of a weird time. And that's, I guess, sort of the ecosystem that these female prisoner scorpion movies came out of.
Yeah, and it's like, what do you consider this? Pinky violence?
It's almost like...
Because, like, to me, pinky violence
too
is more
serious,
like...
or, like, like Girl Boss Gorilla, or yeah. like, you know, they're a little bit more.
It's lighter.
More... They're a little bit tongue in cheek. That like, you know, the sexuality is usually like playful. It's not that abrasive the way it is in these films. Like, you know, there's quite a bit of sexual violence throughout the series, and it's really portrayed in kind of a grotesque way. And I do think of those like Pinky Violence movies as being like, hey, sex is fun, violence in movies is fun, let's like stick them together kind of a formula.
Yeah.
You know, these movies probably have more in common with you know, you think of like the Philippine shot women in prison exploitation films, or like, you know, the Pam Grier, Jack yeah. Hill kind of movies.
The Eddie Romero, yeah. Corman era stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Like this feels a little bit closer to that in its like leery conception. Although I think what makes the female prisoner scorpion movie stand out is you can describe the plot to somebody and that's not really going to do it justice at all, because the two things that I think really elevate these films, you know, one is the star, of course, Meiko Kaji, who like she did have creative input on the character and on the movies, and she's such a unique screen presence. And the other, of course, I think is the style, like the visual style and the kind of creativity, and things are just not done in the way that you might expect, you know, sort of like women in prisons exploitation film to be, you know, like, there's so much visual innovation and imagination.
Yeah, and this like this series is probably my favorite film series, like ever, because mm-hmm. it's just so like creative and bizarre. And there's like to me, like these are the perfect balance of art house and sleaze. And so for me, it's like just the perfect mixture of things I like.
I always like things that kind of fall right on that line, kind of in between the genre filmmaking and maybe the art house, and like what sits on that line between the two, or like sits right in between on the Venn diagram. It's always kind of interesting, I think, because, you know, these sort of exploitation films, movies on the fringes, you can actually say and do things that you can't in mainstream films. So it's actually like an interesting place to have a creative voice.
Yeah, like I also like in comparing like this cycle of movies and I guess like some Pinky Violence stuff too. Like this, I like the, like, and even though it's like sleazy and violent and it deals with like real life stuff, it's still this so creative compared to like the Corman school of like grindhouse like exploitation movies. Because like you look at like the American exploitation from the same era, it's a little more slapdash, it's a little like cruder, and there's no like sense of art in like here. In general, no sense of art. Like there's good stuff out there, like Jack Hill stuff, but overall,
I know what you mean. Like, you know, even though I'm sure they were working on kind of comparable budgets and schedules, like Shunni Ito, you know, you can tell there's like this determination to just make it an art film, you know, yeah. No matter what. He kind of drags the whole premise in that direction, and you know, like every single shot seems like it's as artfully composed and thought out as possible. And it's such a strong creative voice. I think it was his first film, right? Shunni Ito. Mm-hmm. But he had been like a second assistant director for
Seijun Suzuki
quite a long time leading up to that. Yeah, like I think the Seijun Suzuki influence you can like really see in these films.
Especially Jailhouse 41. That just feels like a straight up
Suzuki. Yeah, the Jailhouse 41, like, I probably like the first film best, but I think like the second film has a lot of my favorite moments because it just goes so far out there in the visual style and kind of the artistic choices. I think the director of the fourth film, Yasuharu Hasebe, he also worked with Suzuki, right? As like a third AD, I forget on which film, but...
Yes, he also worked for Suzuki.
Yeah, like the fourth film, Grudge Song, it also feels Suzuki influenced, but like in a completely different way than the first three films.
Yeah, it feels like the like closer to late era Suzuki, like the post Mikatsu era, which you get a little bit in like it's not Fighting Allergy. It's one of those lesser known ones from the mid '60s, like without Joe Shishido. Like, he did some other, like, more tamer but interesting stuff that, like, Tattooed Life is what I'm trying to think of.
Okay. Right, like, because I think, like, a lot of people, they hear Suzuki and they immediately think of, like, Tokyo Drifter, Branded to Kill, and, like, they have that in their head, but there's a range to his filmmaking that, I guess, doesn't always get seen. And, like, Grudge Song, it's much more, like, there's a lot of handheld camera. It sort of tries to, it feels like they tried to put the character back into the real world a little bit, and it's still stylized, and it's still, like, stylistic flourishes, but there's parts where I was thinking of, like, you know, William Friedkin's filmmaking a little bit, where it's like a little bit more grounded, and it mixes the almost documentary style, mm-hmm. like handheld camera, with, you know, the more outrageous flourishes. You know, I thought a little bit of like Sorcerer or The French Connection watching the fourth one. I don't, like, I was a little bit surprised that it seems the consensus by far is that the fourth one is the worst out of the originals. Which, like, I really like the fourth one. I thought that was really, really a good conclusion for the character.
Yeah, the fourth one, I always, like, this, I'm going to get real. I watch it the second time for this podcast. In other ones, I've seen at mm-hmm. least four or five times. Like, that fourth one just, like, I don't know. Like,
it's because it sort of feels like the odd one out. Yeah. Like, it doesn't really match. But at the same time, like, it feels sort of necessary as a coda for the character, because the preceding one, Beast Stable, I think you could tell that, like, Shunya Ito was a little bit done with these movies and Mike Okazaki wasn't. Like, you know, the ending of Beast Stable, it's it has the text, you know, Matsushima went back to prison and served out her sentence. What became of her, nobody knows. It almost feels like Shunya Ito, like, flicking the lights off on his way outside, you know, as soon as he's done work, kind of a thing. And Beast Stable, there's still, like, a lot of great stuff. I think that opening, especially when it's on the subway. And
yeah, and that one, Beast Stable, feels, whereas the first two feel like Seiji Suzuki, Beast Stable feels like Kenji Fukasaku. Down to the casting of the detective who gets his arm cut off, Mikio Narita, who is in Battles of Honor Humanity and a bunch of other Fukasaku stuff.
I could see that, like, there's more of a detective kind of thing going on with it,
and there's a Yakuza element. Although it's not as strong as
there's Fukasaku,
but it's still, like, it feels like closer to that world than Suzuki.
That's true. Like, I think that's sort of by nature of getting the character Scorpion outside of the prison setting. Like, I think maybe if the whole third film was in the prison, it would start to feel stale at that point. And, like, it still feels pretty claustrophobic when you have, like, that sewer sequence and stuff. But, you know, it's kind of interesting trying to bring her outside into the real world a little bit more. But it's still, you know, sort of a fantasy version of the real world.
Yeah, I like that the real world feels like it could turn into, like suddenly, like, a bunch of yokai could show up, and it'd be like, yeah, of course, yokai exist in this reality. It makes perfect sense.
There's parts in the third one that are so strange too. Like, it kind of feels like,
the lead villain, forgot her name. She looks like someone from Funeral Prayer Roses, like the makeup, the costume. And also, Kat Ellinger and extras on that disc says, like, it says the exact same thing. Like, she looks straight up, like, cut out from that movie.
That's funny, actually. The sort of, like, over-the-top makeup, and, mm-hmm. and, like, it's a little bit draggy, I guess. But, the thing I recognized her from is Mishima, Life in Four Chapters. She's in one of the segments, and I don't know, my mind immediately went to that when I saw her. That also has kind of, like, a distinctive visual style, and sort of the segment she's in has, like, a color palette that's full of, like, purples, and it's sort of ostentatious looking, so it sort of made sense to see her in Beast Stable. Like, Beast Stable, it also feels like maybe that's the one where Scorpion as a character gets a little bit lost in the shuffle the most. Like, it's sort of, you know, there's the whole thing with the woman and her brother, and then there's, like, the stuff with the competing gangster, and it starts to feel a bit like that Death Wish sequel effect, where it's like, wait, what? Why is she getting revenge on this person at this point? And, you know, you start to, like, kind of question, like, okay, what? Like, wait, why is she doing this? And I sort of, like, one thing I liked about mm-hmm. Grudge Song is it kind of brought it back and made it personal and kind of made it about her story for the conclusion.
Yeah, like Beast Stable is like the crazy one of the bunch, which is saying a lot because it has like the abortion sequence, which like an American exploitation movie of like from the same year
probably wouldn't touch.
Yeah, would not show abortion as like the medical safe way in and like the horrible, you know, like other way. And it's like it's just pretty astounding some of the stuff it does, but at the same time, it's just so. Like, I don't know.
Can you describe the opening scene? Because I love it. That's like as far as the cold opens go, I think it's the best one.
Oh yeah. So Scorpion is on the subway, and she gets spotted by a couple detectives who are on her trail, and I think she kills one of them, like stabs him in the chest, and then she gets handcuffed to one, and the cop's arm gets stuck in a door, and so. She has to escape, so she just cuts off his arm and runs away.
And that, like later on, you see her gnawing on the arm to kind of get the handcuff off, and a dog gets hold of it, so it becomes kind of like a Yojimbo reference where you see this dog running around with a severed hand arm. You know, the way she's shot, she's like almost a feral character at that point. I don't know if that's part of the reason why it's called Beast Stable, but like, you know, just that image of Meiko Kaji like hunched over in the bushes like gnawing on this severed arm is pretty ridiculous and great.
Yeah, and like she like hid it in the bushes, and it's like it's like literally like catching a wild animal like while it's feeding, the way it's like framed and everything.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Beast Stable, that's the one where Meiko Kaji has the least dialogue. Like, I wasn't even sure if she had, like, any lines. I had to go back and double-check, actually. I'm like, wait, did she play the whole role mute? But
she says four things. I think she says Yuki four times, maybe.
I know Grudge Songs, she has maybe, like, two or three lines, I think. She says, like, oh, here they come. Or it's really, really sparse. Like, I think you can look at her performance, and it's basically a silent film performance.
Yeah, more or less. Like, and I don't know if how available these were, but it feels like an influence on Ms. 45.
Yeah, I could actually see that. Ms. 45, and I've seen some people kind of make that correlation between like how she plays the role and like Clint Eastwood, but Ms. 45 actually makes more sense in the way the dialogue's done. Like,
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood says way more things than I think she does probably in all four movies in the Fistful of Dollars or, you know, any of those.
Yeah.
And like, I keep thinking too, like there's like almost like a Louise Brooks kind of quality to Meiko Kaji's on-screen presence, you know, the expressiveness, and, you know, it's a little bit different because like Meiko Kaji, especially in these films, she can be so intense. Like the tiniest little gesture on her face can kind of say so much. I think it's really, really amazing to see. And like, she has maybe the most intense stare I've seen in a film. Like, it's so amazing.
I would not want to get that stare from her in real life. I would feel like my life.
No. Like, I feel like it gets overused when you say, like, oh, somebody has a piercing gaze. You know, it's kind of a cliche, but it's like, oh my gosh, she really has that. Like, I think there's is it the first one where it ends with her looking right into the camera? I guess she does maybe more than one, but like, I just remember there's this shot where she, like, turns and looks right into the camera, and it's like, I had to look away. Like, it was too intense for me to stare at. I was like, oh, like, I can't handle this. It makes me too uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, you're talking about, because immediately I had to, like, play video games just to calm down. It was just a little
it's too much. But she's so good in these, like, I don't know, it's a really interesting performance, and I think, like, it's kind of amazing how it sustains four films, and, I checked out some of the later movies just out of curiosity. And
like the current ones, or the other ones from, there are a couple others from the 70s without her, and there's...
Yeah, like, there's one where it's, like, supposed to be her sister who wears the exact same outfit as her. Going out and causing trouble, and like, it just doesn't work. I don't think, like, it's not bad necessarily, but, you know, like we said, the things that make these movies special, it's the, directorial style and her performance. And when you take those away, it's like, there's not really that much to work with if you're going to try to bring it back or make another one. You know, it's too distinct. Like, she's unique. So, you know, who else are you going to find to kind of breathe life into that character?
Yeah, like Meiko Kaji, like really, I feel like she was like the driving force behind these movies getting made because she had the reputation for being a quote unquote difficult actress, you know, code
Yeah,
for
that, like,
a woman
Nikatsu was basically like, oh, take your clothes off. And she's like, nope. So I'm going to leave and go over to Toei. And they're like, oh, can you take your clothes off in our films? And she's like, nope. But
yeah, so like,
yeah.
like comparing her to the other like Mickey Violent stars like Reiko Iika and Miki Sugimoto, like her personality on screen is vastly different from theirs, and like I like the other Pinky Violence stars too, but like Kaji just feels like she shouldn't be lumped into that, and I don't know, like I like that that these movies happen to exist, and it's like, oh yeah, she actually found her the thing that she wanted to do, and then like after these movies, in Lay Snowblood, she kind of had a whole career of being like a supporting actress, more or less.
Yeah. Like, she has something like 100 acting credits, but a lot of it's like, you know, like smaller parts in bigger films, you know. Like, she, like, I was reading somewhere there, I might have been in the book that Arrow released about her, where, you know, there was an interview with her saying, like, you know, they're giving parts of like the mother of the family to like 35-year-olds. Like, you know, what am I gonna act in? But, you know, she still keeps acting. And she's mentioned, like, oh, you know, I'd like to work with like Kiyoshi Kurosawa or Takashi Miike, or, you know, those kind of like crop of young filmmakers who grew up basically watching her in the Scorpion movies or the Lady Snowblood films. And you can kind of like see how those movies might have shaped a younger generation of filmmakers in their boldness and their kind of outrageousness and style. You know, like, I could actually see, you know, maybe there's a strong through line between like, you know, female Scorpion, Prisoner 701, and like Audition, which is also kind of this woman in black taking it out on this like authoritarian kind of male figure. And you know, that goes a little bit differently in that film, and that's a horror movie. But, you know, like, there's some, I could definitely see like if there's some connections between the two. There's also like, I think maybe especially in Jailhouse 41, I kept thinking a lot of sort of experimental Polish filmmakers. It reminded me of a couple of times. Like, there's a few points watching these movies where I was thinking of like Kieslowski. Like, there's a shot where she's having sex with the gangsters that like her police officer boyfriend's convinced her to go and sleep with, and he's setting her up, and it's like shot through a glass floor, and it's almost the same as something you'd see in I think it's Double Life of Veronique. And you know, or like there's a part in Jailhouse 41 after the women make their jailbreak, and they have this like heavy blue filter, and they're kind of wandering around the gravel pits and this like, you know, almost sci-fi looking landscape. And I was thinking like, oh, that looks almost the same as On the Silver Globe. Like, you know, you could take a still and it would look like it could pass for a still from On the Silver Globe. And I think it's just like coincidence, but that's sort of where my mind went when I was watching Jailhouse 41. Like, it
Yeah,
has that same kind of.
and those sequences, I'm gonna try to keep talking about this person to a minimum, but those sequences remind me of Django Unchained, and
Okay.
when they're like Django and King are going across the landscape together, if the music is like it just feels identical to it, the way the way that the score fits in, and like the way you see him framed walking across like this bizarre landscape.
I mean, that makes sense, because like Tarantino is obviously somebody who's seen these films and reference them, you know, more openly in stuff like Kill Bill, where the theme song's used, and like there's a lot of visual kind of references to Meiko Kaji movies. I heard she got offered a part in Kill Bill and turned it down. So,
Yeah, that's the right move to make.
well, I was sort of curious like what the role would have been. And it might have been cool to see like her on screen with like Sonny Chiba again or something like that, but I
Oh,
was like,
yeah.
you know, would it have been the Lucy Liu character, or would it have been like a whole new character that got cut out, you know, if she said no? Like, I was kind of wondering like where she would have fit into that movie.
It's
You know,
because
it's sort of
Sonny
so.
Chiba did say yes. And I feel like maybe having both of them might have been a little distracting.
Maybe. I mean, like, you know, the whole thing's meant to be sort of a melange of these kinds of movies, so. I heard it did kind of create a resurgence in Meiko Kaji's music career.
That's good.
She released a new album and stuff like that.
Yeah, cause like we should say like part of like the Toei like Pinky Violence era thing was like the starlets would always sing their own songs, and so they would have their own singing career, and I think men would too, cause like Tokyo Drifter, you know, that's Nikatsu, but the star of that was a pop singer, and that.
Right, that almost feels like a parody of the idea of like the star kind of singing their own song, but I think it works especially well in the female prisoner Scorpion movies. It's like the same theme song over and over again, but it works really well because the character has so few lines. It kind of feels like the singing is her voice in a way. Like it gives a voice to this character who's mostly silent throughout these films, so it actually feels
Yeah.
important.
Oh, going back to the glass underneath shot, that makes me think of Russ Meyer with his that really weird thing he does of like the mattress spring shot that he does for sex scenes.
Oh, right. But like I think also too, people coming in looking for you know, the sort of like titillation you might expect from an exploitation film might be sort of barking up the wrong tree, I guess. You know, like one thing I actually kind of appreciate is just how abrasive they made a lot of the sexually violent scenes, you know. And I understand that was kind of like the mandate of the studio of the day. It's like, oh, you know, we need to have this in a movie, but you know, they'll shoot these scenes and like it's all just a close-up on like Meiko Kaji's glaring face, you know. It's or these like horrible guys making these like deliberately grotesque expressions. There's nothing about them that's made to be titillating, I don't
To
think.
quote John Waters discussing Russ Meyer movies, it's not jerkable.
That's the ultimate test, I guess. If well, like I mean, how do you feel about the sort of
Well, there's a podcast
sexual violence
I
stuff?
used to listen to, but then they did a House episode that came off kind of creepy for
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
you can figure out why. But they had an episode on 701. And they're complaining that like it's just too the nudity is too sexual, which makes me think like how can you see this nudity as sexual in this movie? Like it's like 'cause like the first nudity you get is just
Well, because like so much of the nudity, it's about like specifically the dehumanization of the prison
yeah,
system.
'cause like the
Like,
first bit of nudity you see is just a line of nude women being inspected like cattle, and there's
yeah.
nothing sexy about it. It's just humiliating and uncomfortable and just an ugly thing to look at, because you have these fully clothed male guards like just having a great time, and then you see us like you know this literal like cattle line being inspected. And I think there's no like quote unquote like good like sex scene until the fourth one.
And that's sort of setting up for like a tragic ending. Like,
Yes, so
you know, I mean, so much of the film, it's sort of about like degradation and this character trying to, you know, I mean, she does maintain her dignity and sort of lashes back at these figures who try to impose things onto her. You know, the character's been unfairly put in prison, and it's like her fighting back, and that's kind of what makes these movies. I don't know, maybe like who am I to say empowering, but like that's what makes me root for the character
yeah,
and
like
care about the character. And
I mean, there are some like female film critics and writers, like Keira Janice is on the Treehouse 41 disc, and she talks about like to her these movies are like the ultimate feminist films. Like she gets a real kick out of them. She said all her most feminist friends love these movies, and like Kat Ellinger talked about the same thing on the on her segment. So like there definitely is something there, like this, like as a man, I don't know if I could comfortably say that. Like, sure. Like they could rebrand these movies with like the tagline "Men are trash," because like no man comes out looking halfway decent in these movies.
And well, I mean, these films were successful like at a time when there were a lot of these like sort of sleazy films being made, and I think that's actually kind of what makes them stand out. Partly is it's not just like titillation with, you know, a bit of violence thrown in. Like, there's an actual. There's a message going on.
Yeah, and the other, like, Pinky Violence, well, I don't know if you call it Pinky Violence, but, like, the other movies competing with it, like Sex and Fury and the Girl Boss series, like, I like those, even though, like, those are dealing with, like, those are trying to have it both ways. And picture, like, Sex and Fury, because there's, like, that fight scene where Reiko Ika is nude, and she...
The nude fight scene,
yeah. Slicing up dudes, and it's, like, this weird mix of, like... You see boobs bouncing, but then you see like people getting their hands cut off. So like it's just a weird mix. It kind of depends on the movie, and I feel like some like I see online sometimes people just like reduce this whole subgenre as like it's just trash, or it's like no, you need to actually watch more than one of these movies to actually form an opinion, because it really varies depending on the movie.
Absolutely. And like, from what I've read, Shunya Ito had sort of a political mindset. Like, I don't get like all the political allusions in these films, but I think like I get enough of them to tell that he's definitely criticizing aspects of society, you know. Like, one thing I thought was really interesting were like a lot of the allusions to World War II era Japan and the sort of war crimes that were committed during that period. Like, some stuff, I wasn't sure if, like, oh, is it a reference or not? Even calling it Female Prisoner 701, like, I kind of wondered if it was maybe a little bit of a reference to the Unit 731, which was, you know, doing terrible experiments on prisoners, I think in Manchuria during World War II, and he had, like, all these horrible crimes committed on prisoners. So, like, I wondered if maybe there was meant to be, like, some connection there. I don't know if there is or not, but there's like definitely allusions in Jailhouse 41. Like, there's those guys on the bus.
Yeah.
And like, it's sort of weird.
Oh yeah, they talk about like Manchuria.
That kind of caught me off guard. Like, I wasn't expecting, you know, a character to talk that openly about rape and war crimes, you know. And
yeah, well.
Like, it's still a, you know, controversial subject, but it's... You know, when he's talking about, like, what they did in China, and it's just, like, you know, this character's sort of joking about it, and of course, like, you know, they have to get their due in the film, but, you know, you have people who are more, maybe on the patriotic side, nationalistic side, who, like, don't want to acknowledge some of the stuff today, and you have people, like, you know, I think probably Shunya Ito, who want to draw attention to what happened, you know, in these films. And you know, like, that's sort of what I was saying earlier about the exploitation movies and movies that exist on the fringe and don't necessarily have a budget. Like, that's where you get to say that stuff, you know. It's not in the big mainstream kind of blockbuster realm where you can
there's too many producers and like money people looking at you, making sure you're not, you know, being too extreme.
Right. Anyway, like, so that was just something I thought was kind of interesting about these films. And like, there's definitely a political dimension to them, you know. Shunya Ito, they mentioned he was like the head of the Labour Party at that time, so like he was pretty politically minded. But there were things I didn't pick up on. But like, I think one of the special features on the Blu-rays, they mentioned, oh, like the Jailhouse 41, there's a lot of allusions to the United Red Army incident, which was sort of like a Waco type situation.
Oh yeah, and there's a interview with Yasu, the other director, the guy who did the Stray Cat Rock movies, who did Grudge Song. Oh, and the first thing he says is
Hasebe.
Yeah, Hasebe, and he's first thing he says is, "I don't." Basically, says like, "I don't make my movies political."
Which, I like. How can you make a film that's so anti-authoritarian and not consider it political to some degree? But
apparently he just never considered his movies political. Like, he talks about his work as like, I worked under Suzuki. I like Suzuki. He names a bunch of American directors like John Huston, and I haven't written down, but like John Huston was the one I remember right now. And like he said, like, I wanted to make movies like John Huston and Suzuki. And that's kind of how he talked about filmmaking overall.
I mean, maybe that's one thing that also makes Roach Song stand apart. Like, it does feel a little bit less like it's about some political subtext and more just about the character. And it is weirdly more of a character piece, the fourth one. And, I mean, we mentioned the sex scene earlier, but, like, the way it's shot, the sex scene in the fourth one, it's so tender.
Oh, yeah.
Where you had, like, you have this character who's kind of a foil to Scorpion. Like, his name's Kudo. And, like, you know, when you see all those scars in his body and, like, you find out, like, he's a very hurt person and he's sort of a mirror of Meiko Kaji's character. And, you know, that scene, the sex scene, how it starts with him just, like, holding his hand out to her and she holds it. And it's, like, these two people who are really damaged just trying to put their lives back together and kind of try to find some normalcy, you know, and go back to that. And then, of course, you know, in female prisoner Scorpion fashion, he has to betray her. And I thought it was, like, really actually kind of heartbreaking, that the scene where she comes to get revenge on him at the end, which, you know, it's like the first three films, whenever you see her in the black hat, the coat, it's like, oh yeah, like, she's gonna go get revenge, like, this is pretty great, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like the most fun part of any of these movies. It's kind of like when she actually gets out of the prison and goes to, you know, kill all the bad guys and get revenge. But, like, here, it, you know, the way they play it, it's sad because it's like, oh, he was expecting her and she has to kill out of a feeling of revenge, basically, this person who she actually had a connection with. And, you know, she sort of hugs him and stabs him.
And as the series goes on, like, she gets more human that way, because, like, it starts out,
yeah,
the first one, she's out this one's get revenge against the man who, like,
put her in prison.
Yeah. And, like, who was her first. It gets brought up a couple times. Like, when you see them, like, have sex for the first time, you see a blood stain, the white sheet, in the Japanese flag, which, again...
Yeah, it looks like the Japanese flag when it... Yeah.
And I think, like, the first image...
Again, referring to, like, political imagery in these movies. Yeah,
I think the first image you see in the first movie is the Japanese flag, or one of the first ones. Or maybe it's the Jails 41. But Hasebe talked about other... I found a list of directors. He said his favorite directors growing up, because after the war, as, like, a lot of American movies came in, he said John Ford, Howard Hawks, Raoul Walsh, Sean Huston, Don Siegel, and Sam Peckinpah.
That's quite different from, like, the filmmakers that Shunya Ito kind of cited as his influences. He was, like, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Bergman, Buñuel, Fellini. Like, that was his influence for the first three. So it's sort of funny that these first three kind of feel so close together, but, like, the fourth one, like, it is sort of like, you know, a thumb next to a bunch of fingers. But that's part of the reason why I like Grudge Song, is I think maybe if you got another fourth one, that it might have started to feel stale at that point. Like, I think Be Stable, it's already kind of pushing that basic formula, and, like, I think that's why Ito probably wanted to move on.
And that one, like, to me, goes so far, it's like, well, you can't go more extreme without, like, I don't know, I guess you can go into, like, solo territory, but at the same time, it's like,
yeah.
But, like, I don't, but, like, that's kind of it. Like, where else can you go if you're going more extreme with each movie?
You know, so, like, the way Grudge Song kind of says, all right, let's reel in the style, let's try to bring it back to the character, back to the real world. And I think, like, some of the comments I saw is, oh, this one's not as violent, it's boring. But, you know, like, the deliberate pace, the focus on the character, for me, like, it's not the best film of the series, but it was, like, a perfectly satisfying ending to the series, which I think, like, Be Stable wouldn't have been if that was the last one.
It does make sense, but I see a lot of people have Be Stable as their favorite, which I guess for crazy factor, I understand it, but...
Yeah, like, I think it gets a little bit different when you start talking to, like, people who are more into cult movies, like, the stuff they look for in these films. It's, like, you know, it doesn't matter if the other one has better characterization. This guy's arm gets chopped off in the first 30 seconds, you know, so I get that. But, like, you know, from my perspective and following the character throughout four films, it's like, I'm glad it went for kind of a quieter, emotionally resonant conclusion instead of... It also, probably, like, it didn't have the budget for maybe a giant climax either. fourth one, like, if I had to guess, like, that might have been the one that was made with the lowest budget. I don't know for sure or not, but it just kind of felt that way. And, you know, some of the documentary footage might have been to kind of get around, or not documentary footage, but the handheld camera and stuff like that might have been to get around the budget a little bit and still make it look stylish. But, looking at the release dates for these films, it's a little bit hard to imagine how difficult it must have been to shoot. Like, I think the first one came out, what was it, like
'72.
August of 72, and I think the last one came out December of 73.
That was a studio system that they worked under. It was like, you gotta like make the movie, you get a little break, and then you make the sequel immediately after.
Like, that's nuts, you know, to do, you know, a year and a half, four movies.
Yeah, that's what I kind of like about the Japanese exploitation too, is just like this how fast they crank out a series, and then like one won't make money, so like they just cancel the series after like four or five in a row, and then they just move on to the next thing, which is kind of, I think, why they burnt out so quickly on like the Pinky Violence
Yeah.
era so fast.
That's what, like, you can talk about, like, oh, this era of Japanese filmmaking, and it's like, oh, wait, that lasted like 3 years tops. You can kind of narrow it down to like very specific windows in time when something was a trend or not.
Yeah, and like look at all the Yakuza movies Fukasaku did.
Oh, I know. Well, like, I guess this is around the time like the Battles Without Honor or Humanity movies were coming out. Like, I think they just came out a little bit before these, right?
I think 72, 73, it's around the same time we started.
Yeah. You know, so there's like that big boom of all the gangster movies, and not that there weren't gangster movies before, but
Yeah,
like,
a different style of gangster
you know, you
movie.
see one thing is successful and it like kicks off this like massive wave of
Yeah, but
imitators. And like, even like just talking about like some of the female Scorpion movies they tried to make after these four, I was trying to figure out, like, you know, before we even talked about doing this episode, when I was looking, I was like, oh, is that a real sequel? Is that a parody? Is that a like porn version? Like, there's like Nikatsu's like female prisoner 101, and I'm like that is, oh, is that an official one? No, it's like a porno
It's
parody, I
another, like,
guess.
yeah, I guess there must be like a whole series of Roman porno versions.
Yes. You know, there's like there's knockoffs, there's like kind of official sequels. It gets pretty messy pretty quick, so it makes sense to narrow it down just to the four with Kaji. But you know, it's hard to imagine like a reboot working without her. So I was wondering if you have like any favorite visuals in these movies. There's so many, it's hard to narrow them down, but
I would say just like the whole of Jailhouse 41 is kind of like, for me, just I just love the whole movie. Like, that's one of my favorite movies, period. Like, that was love at first sight for me. And the sequence with when the old woman dies and she like turns purple and she turns a different color, and like.
oh my, I love that scene so much. Like, the whole film's great, but that middle section when it's, you know, that like these women prisoners wandering around the countryside, and they go to the little babushka's home, and like it just kind of collapses around her, and she's like in there as this house falls apart all around her, and the way it's lit, it's like I don't know, it's so theatrical, but
Yeah,
it works so well, and it.
it feels like part of it feel like a no play, because then you get like that the backstory of all the
You
girls.
know, there's a candle representing each one, and the way they kind of like float forwards in this like dark black box theater kind of style,
Yeah,
and explain their backstory, you know.
like just a pause long enough that's kind of awkward, or like what's gonna happen next.
And then like when the little old lady, the babushka woman, dies, and like
She turns
the
into
way
like
the
a
leaves
pile
sort of
of
cover
leaves. Yeah.
her, yeah. I mean, it's more graceful than like when Robert De Niro gets like eaten by newspapers in Brazil, but you know, she just kind of like floats away. It's like, you know, she's one with the force, like Obi-Wan Kenobi or something. But it's a really, really beautiful moment, the way it's lit, the way the lighting changes, the way the wind's blowing the hair.
And that's like her transformation into a demon, which you get, I think, in
Yeah.
the first two, maybe the third. There's another like hair moment where like she turns to a demon, but like it's just like this really great symbolic, like the visual symbol. And like the first one, like it's done in stop motion when she's after she's
Oh, the stop motion, the hair kind of going
yeah
up. and the lighting changing. Yeah. Because for a second, I thought you were talking about like when the other woman attacks her in the prison and she's got the shank and like her, she has those the blood on her face and like her hair's wild and you know she becomes like this almost demonic image, you know. It's
And then that moment quickly ends out when she stabs a warden in the eye.
yeah, and then it goes like back to normal. I love like the warden getting stabbed in the eye is great, but I love the beginning of Jailhouse 41 when it's like the big ceremony for the warden and she almost takes out the warden's second eye and like the blade, like it goes right through the glasses and like it almost poked out his second eye. I love, I don't know, it's great. Like just for the rest of the, you know, the next Scorpion and then Jailhouse 41, he's just got this like messed up eye for the whole thing.
Yeah, and that feels like Riccio borrowed some of that for that movie.
Right. I mean, like that, I think that's probably like a little bit of the manga styling coming in. Like I haven't read the manga that the female prisoner Scorpion movies are based on, so I'd be curious like how close some of that stuff is to the comics, because like I don't, maybe it's not like comic booky in the way we think of it now with like big superhero movies, but you know it's like hyper stylized in the way that like some comic books and manga are, you know, the way the violence is done, the way you know, the expressions are done. I don't know, you haven't read the manga, have you?
But like besides like other visuals, I just love the like this way lighting is handled in a very theatrical way. Like it just feels it feels like you're watching like a surreal art house play for segments. And in the third one, where was it? I like the whole sequence of the sister who that Nami befriends like boils the water, and she goes to like the Yakuza who was harassing Nami, and she burns him to death with boiling water. And that whole sequence is like so is so like uncomfortable, like 'cause you can tell like she is terrified to like to do it. And it's like just so real and grounded, like in this bizarre like art house like sleazy thing.
I think maybe it's in the second one also. There's the one woman who gets killed by the men on the bus from the bus, and there's this kind of vaginal looking waterfall, and then the you know her body's in the water, so like the water goes red, and that's a really striking moment visually. Like so much of the avant-garde theater stuff is great, like the lighting and the I love the trash heap scene at the very end of the second one too, like the way that looks, you know, they shot at a real dump. And Kaji's nemesis character, this other prisoner woman who's sort of her rival, I guess, for most of that film. You know, you gotta be kind of bold to decide that I'm gonna play my death scene with a crooked eye and not make it goofy, but she's really good too. Well, I don't know, like there is kind of like a recurring thing with the eye, I guess, with the at the end of the Jailhouse 41, the warden, after he gets killed, the glass eye he's been using gets popped out, and then you sort of have this projection into it, and it's like a vision of all the women prisoners running free in this sort of music video style. That's really great.
Yeah, and you get like there's a recurring like I guess a split diopter shot. I'm maybe saying it wrong, of like Nami's face on the ground in her cell, and like the warden or like prisoner or like the prison guards above
Oh,
her that you
right.
get.
It's like the optical shot where it's like they're back to back,
Yeah.
or like maybe not back to back, but like you can see the cells kind of projected. Also, that looks for kind of comic book in its layout.
Yeah, and like you get a lot of those shots of this like her defiant look, like not even like look acknowledging their presence as they're taunting her. And Ito after this, his career is kind of all over the place, 'cause like he went from like did a lot of TV and then he won the Japanese equivalent for Oscars,
Oh,
Oscar for like Best Picture for Grey Sunset.
I really want to see it. I don't think it's like available over here right now, but I guess like the controversy of that film was that it was selected as Japan's submission for the Academy Awards over Kurosawa's Ran, and like it could be a great film. I don't
Yeah.
know. I haven't seen it, but it's sort of it sounds like why would you nominate anything that's not Ran for that year? I don't know. And I'd have to see it. I'd be curious. But like, he made an animated film. He made one of the Lupin the Third movies.
Yeah, just like Seizin Suzuki did, like the man he worked under.
Yeah. And one of his last films was sort of controversial. The one about Tojo. I heard a little bit about it. I think it's on the special features. They talked about it, Pride, where some people... I would have to see the film to have, like, a real opinion, yeah. But I guess some people criticized it for saying, like, Tojo was an okay guy. Like, I think that was sort of the maybe controversy around that film. And, but like,
he's still... Itoh is still alive. He... Last movie was 2013, I think. And
okay.
Yeah, so he might be done, but who knows? But he's still...
Hasebe died, you know, a little while ago, but... Meiko Kaji's still around. Like, I think she's still appearing in new TV shows and stuff. Like, she's still acting, actually, you know, and she's... I think she must be in her 70s now.
Yeah, but she more or less looks the same as she did in the movies.
I saw there was, like, a picture of her face on, like, a 2018 Vogue magazine, I think. You know, she still has that stare. She still looks amazing. Like, you know, I'd be curious to see her in more things. Like, for somebody who's done a lot, I really haven't seen that much. And what I've seen comes from a pretty narrow window of time, I guess, in her career.
Yeah. But the book, the Tom Mez book, I'm not sure how you say it. It covers, like, it's a good overview of her career, even though he does really belittle, like, the other Pinky Violence people. And I don't appreciate that. It's a little too judgmental to me.
I've got the... I don't have a webcam right now, but I've got that, like... I forget if it was Synapse Films, but it's, like, the Pinky Violence DVD collection that comes with, like, a pink foam kind of popping package. Oh, so
I have that.
You have that, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great. And, like, one of the discs is a CD with some of the music, and... I've seen enough of them, like, that, you know, they're fun movies. I don't have anything against that.
Yeah, this comment just seems very dismissive of everything, of all those except for Michael Kaji.
I guess, like, partly for people who aren't as familiar with some of these films or the Pinky Violence films, who maybe, like, expect a certain thing from the female Scorpion movies, you know, it might be seen as a way to kind of legitimize the female Scorpion movies artistically to some people, but kind of belittling the stuff that surrounds it or that it's somewhat associated with.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, but maybe, like, this, like, by, like, Reiko Ika as much as, like, Meiko Kaji, like, they are very different actresses, mm-hmm. but they, you know, in this short period of time, they both put out a lot of good stuff. Just, Reiko Ika kind of never went beyond, like, the cheapy, like, exploitation stuff.
Even though, like, she was taking, like, smaller parts, Meiko Kaji kind of moved on from that period of career, like...
Yeah, like, she's the one who managed to survive.
Yeah. It was, like, also an interview on one of the Blu-rays where, I forget which filmmaker they were interviewing, but he was like, oh, like, I just knew her from all these TV shows. I didn't know that she could be cool. Like, you know, when they finally sort of discovered the female Scorpion movies and all that.
But, like, a lot of them just, like, quit acting altogether when the movement was over because the industry had moved on from them.
Yeah.
And, like, who was it? Miki Sugimoto from the Terrifying Girls High School series. She became a teacher after she quit being in these movies, which is pretty funny.
And it's also, like, you know, if you hit a point where you're not getting the kind of roles that interest you or the offers that, you know, think are worth your time, like, it almost feels like, why bother staying for some people?
Yeah.
You know,
and
although, like, I always respect the working actor, like, there's nothing wrong with taking a part in anything.
I guess, like, we're wrapping up, but, like, I want to bring up that Hasebe talked about he ended up being a V Cinema guy, which is, like, the director video stuff, which is kind of sad because he actually is a legit good director, just the industry had no use for him anymore. And like, he was making movies when Takashi Miike was starting out, and like other Japanese directors like of that ilk for starting out, which is just crazy because, like, Hasebe was, like, you know, he's a legit guy who made great movies in the 70s, but then just, like, he always talked about, like, he just wanted to find work, and he would just kind of take whatever he could get.
I guess since we're wrapping up, is it okay if I make an on-air confession?
Go for it.
Well, I kind of ripped off some of the visual stuff from Female Scorpion 701 for a film I made, which was, it's kind of like a horror story about a woman who's either a vampire or maybe she just thinks she's a vampire. It's kind of like a George A. Romero's Martin sort of thing.
The Transfiguration.
So, I think just visually, Female Prisoner 701 Scorpion is one of the most amazing films you'll ever see. So I was like systematically like, you know, I'm just going to steal this because this looks great. I don't know.
At least you're admitting it.
I thought I should just throw that out there. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad we could talk about these films because I actually really like these movies. And, I'm not an exploitation movie kind of guy. Like, or, you know, there are cult films I like and exploitation movies I like, but I'm like less a part of that world as some people. But, you know, seeing something like Female Prisoner 701 Scorpion, like, oh, this is really special in the way it's shot and the, not even just like the visual style or the acting, but like the attitude of the film. It's something you try to capture and trying to, you know, you're tempted to imitate to some degree. So like, I'm sure there's other people out there. I was wondering kind of like if Nicholas Winding Refn was super into these movies at a certain point. I was thinking of like some of the lighting combinations and some of the stuff in his films. I was like, oh, I bet, you know, he's probably a fan of
I definitely see that.
These movies.
And I'm trying to think of I love about this series of movies that like this could only have been made in this short period of time. Like, it could not have happened any other point in, like, in film history, pretty much.
Right.
And that's part of why I love it. And, like, there are some other movies, like The Baby and other stuff like that, that I dearly love because it only exists in this one point in time. And can only exist in this one point in time because, like, the industry is like, okay, I guess we're making these movies now.
But at the same time, like, I feel like you can watch it today and still be wowed and still kind of impressed by these films because they feel so special.
Yeah, they definitely stand out from the rest of the movies surrounding it.
Yeah,
and if you're listening to this, get the book on her career, Unchained Melodies. It's really good. It's a quick read. It's also a small book that, like, literally a small book that can fit on your shelf and not take up space. Yeah, that's it. I have nothing else.
Okay. Well, and if people want to find you online, we sort of already mentioned the podcast, but if there's anything you want to plug or your Twitter, feel free to.
Yeah, so We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. You are on it for Melvin Van Peebles, and you're returning for Clockers. That's it.
That should be fun.
What else have I come? I got back into my site, Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema.
I remember you wrote an article about Blinded Woman's Curse a little while ago, right? I remember reading it. Yeah. Like,
that's one of my favorite ones, and I did like a one on
that was a really good piece.
Oh, thanks. And I did one on like the final Seiji Suzuki movie. And by the time this comes out, I don't know what I'll have up. I kind of base it off of what I feel like talking about and writing about. So like last one I did was
that's a good attitude.
Rumpo Noir, which took me a long time to actually write about that movie, but like I like what I wrote. I try my best to also watch that movie. It's definitely a sight to behold.
Cool. And if folks want to follow the show, you can check out at FlixWise on Twitter. I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. The website, of course, is FlixWise.com. And take care until next time, listeners. I'm probably going to play you out with some cool Meiko Kaji music, so enjoy. 憎い悔しい許せない消すに
消えない忘れられない月月な月ぬ女の恨みいぶし夢よ未練と笑われて冷めて見せますまだ冷めきれぬ女女女の頃の恨みいぶし刺したかないが刺さずにゃおかぬ燃える燃える燃える女の恨みいぶし死んで花見が咲くじゃなし恨み一筋生きてゆく女女命の恨み